I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is The Whole Wide World. Puzzling this hour about how to serve breakfast, lunch, and dinner to 6 or 7 billion people without exhausting the only habitat our species has ever had.
We forget that what we eat is our most important, most profound engagement with the natural world. We affect it most directly by our choices of what we eat.
Food is best produced when you take care of ecosystem limits, when food cultures evolve out of the biodiversity.
We're in the early stages of dangerous revolutionary change in every aspect of the environment.
The Whole Wide World is the radio conversation that decodes globalism and its implications about power, prosperity, and identity in the world. We're trying to sort the trends in politics, culture, disease, trade, technology. Some that are pulling the planet apart, some that are pulling it together, some both. No threat is more clearly global than the fouling of this whole planet's environment. The evidence of climate change, water shortages, a crash of species, or collapse of the habitat. But these are threats and warnings like the risk of nuclear annihilation that we've learned to live with, threats we've got a strong impulse to deny or pretend to ignore. So this hour we're testing the force of those dangers by imagining them in your face, down your gullet, on your plate, in the food that the world eats. What if we narrowed the environmental mission to feeding the human race now and for centuries to come? Has modern food production managed our way past a crisis of survival? Just what can you tell from your daily diet about how the old globe and the new globalism are doing? For me, a lot of the urgency in the question came out of a conversation with the polymath historian Jared Diamond. Guns, Germs, and Steel is his classic account of the last 13,000 years and how our ancestors out of Africa spread themselves and the fruits of the earth so unevenly among the continents. Jared Diamond has a peculiar eminence as a medical doctor who is also a UCLA professor of geography. He knows the hunter-gatherers of New Guinea and the evolution of birds from deep study. He seemed as good a guide as any to the very big picture of where we are now.
One way to express where we are would be in what could be the final countdown. What one can say for sure is that within the next 50 years, lots of important things are going to get settled in one way or another, settled either in pleasant ways of our own choice or in unpleasant ways not of our choice. And one can tick off the list of such things. They're familiar. Loss of fresh water supplies, fossil fuels, biodiversity, forests, fisheries, accumulations of toxics, introduced pests, and all of these things are changing at a rate such that we will either solve them ourselves within the next 50 years or they will solve themselves for us. By that I mean that there are a dozen things, all of which we have to solve, and if we fail to solve any one of them, we'll be done in.
Jared Diamond's line is, imagine the Earth's balance as something like a marriage. What's the most important thing in a marriage? It's not to look for the most important thing in a marriage, he says. Because a happy marriage requires getting about 37 things right. Problems with money, kids, sex, or religion might each be enough to bring it down. Similarly with our world, with climate change, killer viruses, and the diversity of species large and small. Avoid prioritizing, Jared Diamond says, but get real and get to work. The ant biologist at Harvard, E.O. Wilson, another of the magisterial voices in American science, gave us an alternative frame for this hour. We were looking at that famous NASA picture of the blue planet, the Earth rising over the horizon of the moon. What it suggested to him, what Ed Wilson wanted us to imagine in that image, was the invisible film, much thinner than a razor's edge from the astronaut's perspective, that contains all life as we know it in the universe. Human beings, and Ed Wilson's specialty, ants, are among the species in that amazing web of life on the land and sea of planet Earth. Take away the 6 billion humans, Professor Wilson observed, and the fragile biosphere would be in balance for all time. But take away the 1 million billion ants, he said, and the whole edifice of living species would be doomed to collapse.
I don't think that life in its more than 3 billion year history has ever experienced an organism like humanity. We are a biological species in a biological world. We are not creatures poised halfway between those creatures and the angels above. We did not descend from aliens put on this planet. We evolved here as a species over millions of years, and our bodies and our minds are exquisitely well adapted to this particular physical environment that we inherited. This is our cradle. It's where we grew up. And as we start perturbing any of that, atmosphere, quality of water, the composition of the plants and animals around us, we are doing it at our peril, because we are moving away from what we were adapted to.
So those are the baselines from two authorities we respect. And the challenge: can we confront the serious disrepair of our home planet? Can we see the human hand in its predicament, even if it might take a lifetime or more to show some improvement? This hour, see the planetary problem close up and bite size. Have a look at the food on your table. Michael Pollan writes about food from the inside, the growing of apples, potatoes, and steer beef, and about what industrial agriculture does to the outside. So he's an expert on the meal before us that we've been wanting to ask about. I'm looking at a Big Mac and fries here, 2 all-beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun with fries, and thinking, here it is, industrialized food for a global age. It's a franchise, McDonald's, oddly enough, that is supposed to keep the peace. Tom Friedman of the New York Times said there had never been a war between two countries that had McDonald's franchises. That was before the Balkans came apart. But we've got some sort of a symbol here. Just in terms of what you can eat, what's the evidence of globalization of our food in this burger? And does it scare you, or rather comfort you?
McDonald's stands for many things. And one of the things it stands for is, yes, cheap industrialized food, but it also stands for American power. And, you know, we're constantly surprised and amazed that people both love this food and hate it. There's something very seductive about industrialized food. The fact that no matter where I am all over the world, I can get a French fry and it tastes exactly the same and conforms to a universal image of the perfect golden French fry. This is an amazing thing, but it comes at an enormous ecological and perhaps spiritual cost, because in order to have a universal, you know, platonic ideal of a French fry, you need a monoculture of potatoes. Mm. And so there's a real...
Explain what that means.
Well, a monoculture is basically a single species, and indeed very often a single variety of a species, grown in incredible profusion over vast fields of the same thing. Because to get that perfect McDonald's French fry, which is unusually long, and they like them long and golden so that they're long enough to come up out of that red box like a bouquet.
Right.
You know, that's what we like, that sense of that overstuffed, that cornucopia, really. Only the russet Burbank gives you that really long potato. So you end up planting only russet Burbanks all over the world. This is, from an ecological point of view, it's an incredibly dangerous and stupid idea. And the reason for that is all monocultures are exquisitely vulnerable to pests, to diseases, to insects, which like nothing better than a giant field of the same thing. I mean, the Irish potato famine was a result of exactly this approach. The Irish, for whatever reason, were planting more or less one kind of potato through the whole country. It was called the lumper. One day, a disease, a blight, a kind of fungal disease, blew in. And overnight, all the potatoes in Ireland and most of Europe died. They turned black. The vines turned black and the potatoes underground turned to mush. And that was because there was a monoculture. Monocultures are very vulnerable. You need vast amounts of pesticide to support the monoculture, to keep it healthy. So you end up with this precarious system, that this perfect French fry requiring all these russet Burbanks, which in turn require all these pesticides. To give you a specific example, when McDonald's is buying potatoes, the one thing they can't stand is, you know, when you slice open a potato, sometimes you see a couple brown spots inside. Well, they mean nothing. It's a cosmetic defect. It's called net necrosis, and it's caused by an aphid that passes around this, I'm not sure if it's a virus or bacteria, and that infects the potato, and it has no real effect on the health of the plant, on the health of the eater, but it's inesthetic. And if you're in the business of selling the platonic ideal of French fries, you have no tolerance for this. The only way that we know to prevent net necrosis in russet Burbanks is to spray them with very powerful insecticides, which we do. And those insecticides are so strong that, in fact, farmers won't go into their fields for 5 days after you've sprayed them, even if the irrigation pivot is broken down, because they know that this pesticide will basically mess with their neurology, their neurotoxins. So we're doing that. We're endangering farm workers strictly for the aesthetic ideal. And if you ask an organic farmer, well, how do you deal with net necrosis? And he'll say, and in fact, I asked one, he'd say, well, I don't have that problem. And I said, why not? I said, well, I don't grow russet Burbanks.
Michael Pollan doesn't grow russet Burbanks either. He did, however, as an experiment, grow genetically modified new leaf potatoes with their built-in pesticide. When it came time to eat them, Michael Pollan said, no thanks.
And so my point is, if we weren't growing potatoes in vast monocultures, we probably wouldn't need potatoes that have been genetically modified to kill bugs, nor would we need a lot of pesticide. So you see how the monoculture in culture, the monoculture of taste, the idea that we should have, you know, the McDonald's ideal, one world, one taste, has ecological ramifications, very, very powerful ones. So there's a connection between biodiversity on the plate and biodiversity in the field. And biodiversity in nature, we understand, is the key to health. I mean, nature never puts all her eggs in one basket. She would never have one variety of potato or anything else growing over, you know, millions of miles of farmland.
That's the fries on my plate. Michael Pollan is saying that the pollution from all those industrial chemicals, fertilizers, hormones, pesticides, is one of the hidden prices of what we're eating. Another uncounted cost is the use of petroleum products to fertilize the corn that feeds the steers that make the burger. Let's talk about the beef in this Big Mac. You write that a steer who may tip in eventually at 1,500 pounds will eat food that has absorbed 284 gallons of petroleum as fertilizer. I'm thinking at 25 miles a gallon, I could drive coast to coast in the United States on the gasoline that will go into that cow's beef. Is this not a problem?
Well, it's not all gasoline. It's gasoline equivalent. I mean, it's fossil fuel.
Okay.
Oddly enough, the way we grow a hamburger in this country does involve a lot of fossil fuel. Now, how should this be? I was kind of amazed to find that we have this animal that's brilliantly designed by nature to digest grass. That is a terrific kind of solar system. You know, the sun feeds the grass, and the grass feeds the cow, and the cow feeds the human. So this system works pretty well, and it's very sustainable. But it doesn't work fast enough for the capitalist system, which is always trying to make a cow reach its slaughter weight as fast as possible. If you keep a cow on grass, it takes maybe 2 years to get it up there. But that's not quick enough. So what do you do? Well, to get it down to 14 months, which is what we have it down to bring a cow to slaughter, if you feed them on corn, they will grow a lot more quickly because it's a more high-energy food. Corn is really cheap. Now, why is corn so cheap? Well, partly because it's subsidized, partly because we grow it with fertilizer that is made from mostly from natural gas. It can also be made from fuel, from diesel or anything else. And that's where you get all that fossil fuel going into the cow. It's first fed to the corn. And so we've taken this system that is essentially was a solar-driven, grass-based system of producing a hamburger or any other piece of meat, and we've turned it into another gas guzzler because it's faster to give all that cheap fuel, natural gas, to create the fertilizer, to feed the corn, then use the corn to feed the cows, and they grow fast. It makes sense economically, because time is money, and corn sells for half the price it costs to grow it, thanks to subsidy. Does it make sense ecologically? No, absolutely not. It doesn't make sense from a population point of view either, because we're growing, you know, more than half the grain grown in this country is grown to feed animals. It could be feeding people.
That subsidized corn is the linchpin of a system that, as Michael Pollan describes it, delivers cheap, fast food for the masses, but makes a habit of hiding what it really costs.
The expression cheap food is really a myth. You know, how is it that we can have a 99-cent hamburger, but behind that cheapness is an incredible trail of expenses having to do with the war in the Persian Gulf to defend our oil supply, having to do with the cost of antibiotic resistance, because in order to get the cows to tolerate all this corn, which disagrees with their digestion, we have to give them antibiotics or they would get sick. Hormones to make them grow even more quickly, and whatever that is doing to the disruption of endocrine systems of humans and frogs and all sorts of other animals. The pollution from feedlots. To feed animals corn, you take them out of the grass and you concentrate them in these cities, these metropolises of meat, where manure, which is a great boon on an organic farm, becomes a pollutant because there's too much of it in one place. So you have these vast waste lagoons and you pollute the local water system. So these are all the costs of cheap food. The motto of our food system should be, something like cheap at any cost.
He's talking about costs that, of course, you never see on your plate.
The hidden price is really, I think, the most, the one that worries me the most is to the natural systems. We forget that what we eat is our most important, most profound engagement with the natural world. We affect it most directly by our choices of what we eat. And when we choose to eat an industrialized hamburger and potatoes, French fries, we are exacting a tremendous price from the environment because there is the issue of moving that food around the world, which is very wasteful of energy, and there is the issue of the vast agricultural monocultures required to grow it, which in turn requires us to use all sorts of pesticides. All these things are linked.
Here's one link. That cheap subsidized corn behind the cheap burger and chicken McNuggets brings a kind of foreign policy with it.
And the other implication of this is we can sell corn more cheaply than people in Africa can grow it. So you are essentially impoverishing already impoverished farmers with our subsidies. I mean, the ramifications of those subsidies are reaching to farms in Nigeria where farmers find that they can't match the price that the market is willing to pay. And they've already been enticed out of growing for themselves and been told, in the global economy, you have to grow for global trade, not for subsistence. I think it's very important that everybody, at least to some basic extent, be able to grow their own food. It's too dangerous to mess around with. We have been, playing with policies in Africa where we're basically weaning people off of local agriculture and the ability to feed themselves.
So there's a start on the global implications of the all-American burger, the monocropping of potatoes, the accelerated factory production of beef, and the hiding of costs, especially in subsidies of petroleum and corn. When we come back, we're going to hear how the World Bank helped design and finance the global food system, and how differently the global food fight sounds on the other side of the world.
For me, globalization in food and farming means pushing people and societies who have the capacity to feed themselves into hunger and starvation.
This is The Whole Wide World, produced in association with WGBH Radio Boston from PRI Public Radio International.